It's my pleasure at this point to introduce Rabbi Yitzhak Echelam. Those of you who were here for earlier today and for the panel have seen his great erudition, his knowledge, his passion, his intensity for Jewish teaching and Jewish thought. He's going to be speaking now on Shaul and the problem of monarchy. He teaches in Los Angeles at the Wiesenthal Center and also at the High School of Yeshiva University of L.A., and it's my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Yitzhak Echelam.
Thanks. I'll be passing the hat around later. Truth to tell, I picked the topic of Shaul and the problem of monarchy because I was asked a number of weeks ago, probably over a month ago, to select some subjects. And the problem of Shaul's monarchy is one that invites a whole range of different topics. And I always like to keep myself open so that whatever is really interesting the week before when I'm putting together the source material will be something that somehow fits. And you'd be surprised Thursday night and Friday morning when I decided to put together the source material, the range of things I was thinking about. No, I wasn't contemplating things that have the same gematria as Shin Aleph Vav Lamed. But I decided to cut to the core, to the real problem of Shaul as king. Unfortunately, or fortunately, a majority of the time we're going to spend, because we have, as it is, about 47 minutes. Right. 47 minutes, I make, because it's 12:30. Is going to be background. But it won't be, hopefully, tedious background, etc. Hopefully it will be illuminative. Into the whole problem of monarchy and the specific problem of Shevet Binyamin. Let's start at what would appear to be the beginning. And then I'm going to suggest something that may sound a little radical. Yaakov is on his deathbed. He calls his sons together, and he does what? Blesses them. That's what we think. However, that's not what it says. We have to pay close attention to the text, because I didn't have room. I'm always very careful to only print one page, back and back, because I don't like people to feel like they're getting a whole Megillah. We did that beforehand anyways. I'd rather have them be able to have one page you can mark up, page you could take home. My email address is at the bottom. If you have any questions, feel free to send it to me. Those of you who are interested can follow the ongoing Megillat Esther Shiurim on the podcast. So what did Yaakov do? He called his sons together and said, "Gather, I'm going to tell you what will happen at the end of days." There's no blessing here. There's prophecy. And I know that there's no blessing here because he goes in order, and what's the first, what does he say to Reuven? He doesn't say, Yisimcha Elohim Kefraim V'chim Menashe. What does he say? You blew it! Then he calls Shimon and Levi together. And he says, you really blew it! What? Thank you. Good. Yeah, well, and we'll get to where the blessings are. And then we get to Yehuda, who we have on the text in front of us. We'll talk about Yehuda, both within the context of monarchy, but also within the context of Yaakov's deathbed will, if you will. He's followed by Zvulun, Lechof Yamim Yishkon, Yisachar Chamor Garem. It's very hard to discern any blessings here, but certainly the first three have not started off well. Dan Yadin Amolke, Achad Shiftei Yisrael, etc., God, Gedud, Yugdenu, etc. Ben Porat Yosef, and then Binyamin Ze'evi Traf. Now, after Binyamin, we have the following pasuk. Kol Eile Shiftei Yisrael Shnei Masar. That's the whole Mishpucha. Vezot Asher Diber Lahem Avihem Vayivarech Otam. Ish Asher Kivir Chato Berach Otam. Ibn Ezra here reads, Vezot Asher Diber Lahem Avihem Vayivarech Otam. Meaning, this is what the father told him, and besides that, he also gave them a blessing. In other words, the blessing is the blessing. We don't have a record of that blessing. Besides that, he also told them these things. In which case, what is the these things that he told them? Well, it seems quite clear, and anybody's interested, take a look in Divrei HaYamim Aleph, Perakei Pasuk Aleph, that it's not on the page, and there's a lot of text that's not on the page because there's just one page. That Reuven was supposed to be considered the Bechor, Uvachalalo Yitzu'e Aviv, when he desecrated his father's bed. However we understand the story with Bilhah, he slept with her, or like most of the Midrashim say, he moved the bed. Whatever he did, he lost his Bechorah, v'nitna Bechorato livnei Yosef. And the Bechorah was given to Bnei Yosef. In other words, what Yaakov here is doing is he is assigning the family estate. Reuven was supposed to be the Bechor, he blew it, he's been demoted. Shimon and Levi, you are dangerous, you can't be together, you need to be separated. And by the way, he is echoing what his favorite son Yosef did by pulling Shimon out of the group and keeping him separated. And indeed, your children will be spread out throughout Israel. So we're going in order. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, next, Yehuda. Let's see what he says about Yehuda. Now we're on the page. Yehuda, ata yoducha, what? I ignored that in favor of, wait, I mentioned that, that the Bechor was taken away from Reuven and given to Yosef. And how was it given to Yosef? By having two tribes become... Yeah, but that's not here. That's in Memchet. Oh, Memchet's a bracha, sure. The previous scene with the hand cross and Hamalach HaGoel and Elohim HaRaoti and Simcha Elohim, that's all a bracha. Question, who's getting the blessing there? It's not so pasha. You think Menashe and Ephraim's getting the blessing. I think Yosef's getting the blessing. But... regardless, I agree with you. That's a bracha. This is not a bracha until at the end it says he said this plus a bracha. Okay, Yehuda ata yoducha achecha yadcha ba'oref oivecha yishtachavu lecha b'nei avicha. Yehuda, your brothers bow to you. Your brothers accept you. They recognize you. Your hand is on the back neck of your enemies, a sign throughout the Near East of victory. As an example, Yoshua Perek Yod. When they pull the kings out of the cave and they have the general stand with their feet on their necks. I guess that's what our host would call indigestible Torah. All the sons of your father should bow down to you. By the way, notice what did Yitzchak say when he said a parallel phrase? Yishtachavu lecha b'nei imecha. Why does Yaakov say b'nei avicha? Because it includes the other sons who are from other mothers. Good. Gur Aryeh Yehuda. And Yehuda is a whelp. Miteref b'ni Alita, he rises from the kill. Kara ravatz karyeh uchlavi miyikimenu. So Yehuda is powerful. He pounces like a lion. Lo yasur, you know where Yaakov got this? From the stained glass windows. Okay. Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda, umechokek mi bein raglav. This is the key verse for our purposes. The scepter shall never depart from Judah. And by the word, what does the word shevet mean? And what else does it mean? Tribe. What's another word that has that same double meaning? Mateh. Mateh means staff. Mateh means tribe. Why does mateh and shevet mean tribe? Because who holds the staff? The head of the tribe. It's a sign of leadership. And therefore, the one who holds the shevet is the one who runs the shevet. And therefore, the entire mater, the entire shevet, is associated with that person. A little bit of etymology. Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda u'mechokek mi bein raglav. And a lawgiver from between his legs, meaning from his progeny. Ad ki avo shilo. Nobody knows what this means. Machloket all over the place. Until he comes to Shiloh, until the Shiliah comes, the child comes, a reference to David, as some say, v'lo yikatamin. So is this speaking about eschatology? Is it speaking about a certain place in Israel? Unclear. Osuri la gefen iro v'la soreka b'ni atono. And here you get an interesting association. There's a mention here of his donkey, which of course could be real foreshadowing to Zechariah and the Ani Rochev al HaChamor. Osri la Gefen Iro. He ties the wine down, the grapes down, All these mentions of wine. His eyes are red with wine, and teeth cleaned with milk. Now, what is going on here? Before we get to the key phrase that we're worried about, what about those last two lines about wine and milk? What is that about? Why is Yehuda blessed with wine and milk? After all, Yehuda is a lion. You would think that he'd be blessed with tiger meat or deer meat better or something. What's the bit about wine and milk? So to answer that, you look a little bit ahead to Zvulun. It's not on the page, but Zvulun is given the blessing or the direction that he will be riding on the seas. I'm going to ask you the following question, which is an Ur question, a large question. It doesn't affect our topic directly, but it's something that without which Sefer Bereishit becomes a little bit indecipherable. Avraham was given a promise. The promise was that his progeny would suffer as foreigners in a strange land for a really long time. 400 years, as Bible talk, for a really long time. And that they would be worked and oppressed, and that God would judge the nation that oppresses them. They would leave with great wealth. The fourth generation will return here, but you will die in peace. That's the Brit Ben HaMetzarim. When did that happen? I mean, I'll start with a question. Did it happen? And if it did happen, when did what? No, I mean, what's the fulfillment of that brit? Well, I'm saying the fulfillment of the whole brit, not just the first part, not the bad part, the whole brit. What's the event that marks the fulfillment of that brit? See, I'm Mitzrayim. Good. How do I know that? I know because I read the Pasuk at the Seder. No, I know that that is the fulfillment of the brit because all of the pieces are there. They're foreigners, they're in a strange land, you want to see a beautiful development. Rav Ilon gave a shiur a number of years ago in which he showed how each one of the makot fit one of those response to being strangers, to being worked, to being oppressed. Beautiful system. And we came out with great wealth, and the nation that heard us was judged fits perfectly. Which means, by the way, what was the status of our mishpucha until then? Who were we until then? Avraham was given a brit. Subsequent to that, he wandered. He helped to save Lot. The stone was destroyed. He moved to Gerar. His wife was taken. Akedah, birth of Yitzchak, Akedah. Avraham died. Yitzchak has kids. Yitzchak dies. Yaakov runs away. Yaakov comes back. I'm going out of order here, but all of these things happen. What was the status of the family in the meantime? We all know that Avraham had this nevuah. What do we do in the meantime? This is a very important methodological question when studying Tanakh. The only way, and I make this point in my book, which I have to plug because I forgot to, Between the Lines of the Bible, it's available on Amazon.com and Yashar Books, and probably in your local Jewish bookstore. The Wire book sale just got sold out, but they're restocking. It's sold out, but they're restocking. I just got an email. But thank you, because that was a great plug. Is that the only way to properly understand narrative in Tanakh is to walk inside the story. You have to live inside the story and open your eyes and see who's here, who's there, who's listening, who doesn't know what's going on, who walks in late, who hasn't been born yet, what do people know? Because without that, the stories don't make sense. I'll give you a quick example. It's an aside, but it's a great aside. Rav Yoav Ben Nun wrote an article in the premier edition of the Bible journal Megadim a number of years ago that till today raises a firestorm. The question was, why didn't Yosef, once he had become a powerful man in Potiphar's house, and later on when he became the regent of Egypt, why didn't he send a message to his father saying, Daddy, I'm okay? Some of you, I can see from your nods, are already familiar with it, and you're smiling because it's a great vort. It's a great mahalach. But Rabbi Yoel asked the father, he said, why not turn the question around? If you're Yosef, you have to ask the question, why isn't father looking for me? After all, I went off to find my brothers. I never came back. Yaakov's a powerful, rich man. Why isn't he looking for me? And so he goes through the whole Mahalach, but the basic principle of his understanding, which in a very thumbnail sketch form, is as follows, that Yosef became convinced when father sent him up to the brothers, whose hatred for him was palpable, and the tension was so thick you could cut it with a knife, that when father sent him up there, father was sending him there for the brothers to get rid of him. That the brothers had convinced father that since this is a family that has a tradition, that one brother always gets sent away, that the family divides, that the brothers had convinced father it's either him or us, and the majority won. And that it was Yosef's job, just like Yishmael built a life in the desert and Esav built a life in South Jordan, it was Yosef's job to build a life in Egypt. And that all became confused when the brothers came back and started telling their story. The article is available online in English if you're interested. It's available online in Hebrew. The first issue of Megadim. What? I don't know, but just Google Yosef bin Nun and mistake. You'll find it. It's called The Tragic Mistake. It is an amazing article. I don't want to take the time with the article now. You can read it on your own. But the premise of the article is that the only way you can understand what's happening is be Yosef. I'm Yosef. I don't know that the brothers are fighting about what to do with me. As far as I know, the brothers and father are in on this. Now, I'm Yaakov. As far as I know, Yosef's dead. This is a classic he said thing. You know one thing, you know another thing. You're not talking to each other, so you don't know the missing information. And as a result, tremendous calamity happens within the family. The reason I'm bringing it as an example, and maybe it's a little unfair as a tease, but as an example, is you cannot understand what's happening without being the person. Now, let's be the person. I am Yaakov. Right? I am Yaakov. I know it sounds audacious, but we already talked about how we have to treat the Avot as people. So, I'm Yaakov. Yaakov knows the Brit. The family knows the Brit. God spoke to Grandpa and he told him the following thing. Yadoa teda. I now have run away from home because my brother wants to kill me. It's a good reason to run away from home. I run away from home and I am now a stranger in a foreign land. I'm not like Grandpa where I was born in Aram. I'm an Eretz Yisrael diker. What am I doing up in Turkey? So I ran away to Haran. What happens in Haran? I fall into the clutches of the most maniacal, the most deceptive, even worse, a father-in-law. I fall into the clutches of Lavan. By the way, as a general rule, the last session of the conference, you got to be a little funnier because people are going to, I don't know. I'm still trying. He falls in the clutches of Lavan. Things are terrible. According to his own testimony, he is oppressed day and night, working hard with somebody who tries to cheat him out of everything he has. By the way, when does Yaakov decide it's time to go home? What? Vayhi kasher yalda Rachel et Yosef vayomer Yaakov lelavan. I'm going home. Same pasuk. When Yosef is born, Yaakov says to Lavan, I want to go home. And by the way, what happens in the intervening 6 years from then till when he finally leaves? Yaakov makes a series of business arrangements with Lavan, and what happens on each arrangement? Whatever they agreed, Yaakov's going to get, that's what's born. Striped, spotted, little copyright, something born with a heksher. Doesn't matter. That's what Yaakov gets, and Lavan gets the other kind. In other words, God is judging the one who oppressed him. And by the way, let's count it. Avraham got the promise. Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef. Fourth generation returns home. Why Yosef? Why not Reuven? I got news for you. In Yaakov's eyes, Reuven doesn't count. Shimon doesn't count. Levi doesn't count. Yehuda doesn't count. Dan and Naphtali, who are they? God and Asher don't count. Yisachar and Zvulun. You know who counts? I'm going to say it properly. What? Ben Rachel. Thank you. That's exactly who counts. Ben Rachel. I know that. Because when Yehuda is talking to Yosef, he doesn't know he's Yosef. And he says, you got to let Binyamin come back down. He quotes his father as saying, Atem yidatem kishnayim yalda li ishti. You know that my wife gave birth to two. This is Yehuda, son of Leah, quoting father. Which means that the Bnei Leah are ready to admit that in father's eyes he had only one real wife. And that's Rachel. And by the way, he never stops mourning Rachel. Even on his deathbed, he mourns Rachel. Notice it. And so when Yosef, which means the real fourth generation, is born, on that minute, Yaakov says, hey, baby, we done it. Yeah, that's what we teach in LA. Baby, we done it. We got the four generations. We got the oppression. That's cool. We got to do the rest of it. Time to go back. Oh, hey, good. We got the guy judging him. And by the way, when Yaakov runs away, Laban chases after him. And what does Laban say to him with his mouth? I was ready to kill you, but your God came to me and said, you better not touch him. In other words, Yaakov has proof positive that God is judging his enemy. Wow, cool. So what does Yaakov do? Where does he come to? He comes to Shechem. Why Shechem? Because that's the first place Avram went. He comes to Shechem. And what's the first thing he does in Shechem? He buys land. Why does he buy land? Honey, I'm home. This is it. We're done. We've done the Brit Ben Avatarian thing. We're back. So he buys land. Then what happens tragically? Rape. What happens, maybe tragically, maybe not, as an aftermath of the rape? Massacre. I'm going to say this very guardedly. Of all the chivim in Shechem, Shechem is not an isolated city. It's not a desolate city. It's not emptied. But all the chivim in Shechem are wiped out. As far as who remained in Shechem, that's another story. And then where does Yaakov move from there? South. To Beit El, to fulfill the commitments he made. And then to move south to Hebron, to go back to Yitzchak. In other words, he's coming home. Now, what has happened in the meantime in the north? I'll ask you this question. After Yosef and all those dreams and everything. Father sends Yosef to his brothers. Where are his brothers? They're near Shechem, in Dothan. What are they doing? Shepherding Yaakov's flocks. Hello. Why do you have your flocks 50 miles north when there's a lot of good grazing land between here and there? How do I know there's good grazing land between there and there? Because I drive that road all the time and I have to stop for the little kid with all the goats. I know there's good grazing land. So why does he have his flock all the way north in Shechem? By the way, where did Reuven go to for a little while? Where's everybody going? Where'd Yehuda go to? The answer is, they're starting to settle the land. And by the way, what area do you think Shimon and Levi got? Shechem? Reuven's got something nearby? What? Yeah, where'd they go? No, I'm talking about now, when Yosef comes to visit them. So you got Reuven, who's able to go away somewhere for a day and come back, or go away for a little bit of time and come back. You got Shimon and Levi, evidently up there. They're all up in the north. Yehuda's nearby in Timnah, which, by the way, curiously, turns out to be right in the middle of Eretz Yehuda when we look at the map. In other words, they're starting to settle the land. Now, things change radically. There's a famine. It totally messes up the family's plans. They come down to Mitzrayim, and what understanding starts to seep in? It's a phrase that parents never like to say to their kids. We was wrong. The Brit Ben Avatarian has not yet been fulfilled. Haraya, we're back in Golis. So what does Yaakov tell his children on his deathbed? Yehuda, you know where your territory is? It's right there, where Eretz Yehuda is. By the way, drive through Eretz Yehuda. What do you see if you drive south on the tunnel road? What will you see on the right side of the road down the slopes? Lots of vineyards. What do you see on the mountaintop? Lots of goats. Milk and wine. Yaakov is simply apportioning the land. Zvulun is supposed to be by the sea. Reuven, you would have gotten a thing, but instead you got something else. We don't know where Reuven got because Reuven changed their mind and took the East Bank. Shimon and Levi aren't going to get land, and they don't get land. They're going to be spread out. And you look through, what? Shimon and Levi. Because, you know, how was Shimon spread out? Take a look in Yoshua Perek Yud Tet. Para Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Til Pasuk Vav. You'll see that Shimon gets no land. He gets a few cities inside Yehuda. Right? And Levi gets nothing. They get the Arvei Halvim. Yeah.
Yosef should be acting, and Yaakov has no guarantee that it will be fulfilled while he is alive.
Why not necessarily? It says just says Vidora Vi Ashubuhena.
But and then still Yosef is the actor, not Yaakov.
Right.
And Yaakov is the actor.
Oh, okay. I'm with you. Maybe Yaakov, but Yaakov in fact jumped the gun. So we're both right. In any way you want to read it, you're saying that Yaakov's parshanut was wrong. Could be. But Yaakov's read of the situation was also wrong, but that's okay. So, in other words, there was already a pre-settlement of the land. I'll give you an example. Machir is the son of Menashe. Where's Menashe born? Egypt. Menashe's son, his Bechor, is named Machir. Born in Egypt. His son is named what? You know what his son's name is? Gilad. Why did Machir name his son Gilad, living in Egypt? Well, look at the map of where the territory that they conquered. Menashe has Gilad. The mountains of Gilad are right in the middle of Menashe's territory. Why does Yisachar have a son named Shimron? Well, take a look at a map of the territory and you'll see that the town of Shimron is right in the middle of Yisachar's territory. It's on the border of Yisachar and Zvulun. Why does Menashe have a grandson named Chefer? Remember Chefer? Tzofchad ben Chefer? The guy with the great daughters? Tzofchad ben Chefer? Chefer is an ancient kingdom in the middle of Menashe's territory. In other words, they've already settled the land. They've already divided up the land. They know what part of the land is supposed to be theirs. Now they've gone down to Egypt, but they already know where they're going back to. That's what Yaakov's doing on his deathbed. That becomes important for the following problem that we need to get to post-haste. Say it again. Well, because here's a guy named Menashe. He's born in Egypt, with a silver spoon, by the way, right? He's got a kid named Machir, born in Egypt. He's got a kid named Gilad, born in Egypt. Why did he name his kid Gilad? No, but he named him that when he was born. That was his birth name. What? So in other words, when Yaakov and Lavan met on Har HaGilad, it wasn't really called Gilad then. See the problem? Chefer, we know. No, I'm saying Chefer, we even know from external documents, is an ancient kingdom there in the Emek. So in other words, the guy's name wasn't Gilad. Look, it's a possibility. I don't know why the Torah would do that, and only selectively also. Why would the Torah do it selectively? It doesn't do it all the time. Okay, possibly. In any case, the critical thing that I want to get to is that Yehuda ata yoducha achecha, that begins the passage about Yehuda, which carries the famous line, lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda. The scepter of leadership will never leave Judah. Which is understood midrashically and halachically to refer to the scepter of monarchy. That the monarchy will never depart from Judah. It was so important that the Reish Galuta, the exilarch in Bavel, interpreted this pasuk as referring not just to kings, but to heads of communities. Because the exilarch dated himself back. And the house of Hillel and Gamliel, etc., Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, all dated themselves back and associated themselves genealogically with Shevet Yehuda, with the house of David. Great. So that means we know that the kings that Yaakov appointed, that the king in the family always has to come from Judah. Wonderful. Here's the problem. Take a look at the first passage on the page. Sefer Shmuel is one sefer. The reason that we call it Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet is because we relied on the ancient Greek division when it came time to publish the book in printed form, and they were not able to publish a thick book, so they published one part and the other part, and they divided it along those lines, Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet. You know the story about the tour guide who takes his tour to Kever Shmuel in Yerushalayim, and he announces, Kan Kavur Shmuel Hanavi Asher Mashach Shnei Malchei Yisrael Shaul V'David. And of course, nobody's listening. And then the next day, he takes them up to Nevi Samuel. By the way, neither of them are Kever Shmuel. He takes them up to Nevi Samuel, and he says, Kan Kavur Shmuel Hanavi Asher Mashach Shnei Malchei. And one guy's actually listening. He says, wait a second. Yesterday you told me that was Kever Shmuel. And now you're telling me this is Kever Shmuel. What was his answer? That's Shmuel Aleph is Shmuel Bet. Okay. Good. So in Sefer Shmuel, the first seven chapters are one theme, and that is Shmuel. The birth of Shmuel, the career of Shmuel, and really his career is brought to an end even though he doesn't die for quite a while. That's the first seven prakim. The next seven prakim, from Tet through Tetvav, are the career of Shaul. The parak in the middle, parak Chet, is the request for a king. ויישם בנו הבכור יואל, ושם משנה הוא אביה, שופטים בבאר שבע, ולא הלכו בניו בדרכיו, ויצאו אחרי הבצר, ויקחו שוחד, ויעטו משפט. So in other words, he had two sons, and they were lousy. They were corrupt. ויקבצו כל זקני ישראל, ויבואו אל שמואל הרמתה. So everybody came to Shmuel, ואמרו אליו, הנה אתה זקנת, ונחל לא הלכו בדרכך. Essentially, you're old, your kids stink. In not much nicer terms. You're old, you're going to die, and your kids are lousy. Meaning, there's going to be a void of leadership. I'm not going to translate that. They're asking for a king. I'm not going to translate that for a reason. Shmuel was very upset because of the request, and he prayed to God. God then said, tell them what a king is going to do, and he reads a whole list of all the things the king can appropriate. Mishpat HaMelech. He does. The people say we want one anyways. And then Shmuel comes back to Hashem. Hashem says, okay, give them a melech, sends them home, and then the next parak we meet Shaul. Good. What does Lishofteinu mean? And let me ask you a question. The book before Shmuel, which is undoubtedly the greatest argument for a monarchy, because it ends with the words, Bayamim ahem ein melech b'Yisrael. And we have just had a bloody civil war and cuckoo avodah zarah and Nazi behavior, gang rapes, and just really stuff. And so it's a very good argument for a monarchy. What is the name of that book? How would you translate it? Judges. Right, except that not one of them does any judging. Unclear. Unclear if it means that. They're really, right, the leader, what kind of leaders? Actually, they're rebels. They're all rebels. Every one of them is a rebel. Every one of them is somebody who leads a rebellion against an overlord. A justified rebellion. And they're called upon by God, and they have Ruach Hashem on them, but they are rebel leaders. I call them chieftains. That's because I like Irish music. But really, to translate Shoftim as judges is just kind of silly. Because the text in Perek Bet of Shoftim says, Vayakem Adonai Shoftim Vayoshium. God raised up Shoftim, and they saved them, which means, clearly, they're not judges. So now, when they say, we want a king Lishofteinu, what do they mean? I would posit what they mean is, we want a king to lead us in war. And we'll see that a little bit later on. Shmuel is upset. Why is Shmuel upset? Well, first of all, they just insulted him. Right? But good. And that comes up later on. You will see in Perek Yod Bet. I don't think I have that passage here. It's just after the ellipsis of on Perek Yod Bet on the next side. But he says, "You asked for a king. Uvanai hinayim itchem. My kids are here," which means there's a certain amount of parental blindness. By the way, he's not the first parent in Tanakh that we really like to have parental blindness. Who's the first one? What? I think Avraham, right? God tells Avraham, you're not seeing it, Sarah's seeing it. Yitzchak, clearly. Yaakov, evidently. Yosef seems to be, remember this? right? Act like it seems to be kind of an affliction in our families. What? Yeah, I was thinking about that. I don't know. It could be. Could be. Yeah. Yeah.
That isn't an argument to change the system. It's a change who comes after. Because
not only, yeah.
Because you'll have a king, and the king's son won't be any good. How does it solve?
Exactly. Exactly. It's like we were talking earlier about a comment that I made that was not, I didn't make it completely in the panel, which was that our failure to train our high school students in the nuances of Bible scholarship and study is what eventually leads them to, quote-unquote, go astray in college. No, I didn't mean that at all, but it often becomes a very convenient excuse when I want to do other stuff, and now you see what they taught me wasn't right, so I reject, you know, it becomes like, in the same way, I believe that what you have here is, if you think about it, the people are doing worse than what you're suggesting. They are asking for the exact system that would mess things up. Because until now, what kind of system have we had? We've had a dynamic system where the new leader is not the son of the old leader. The new leader is as per need, and God chose him. Right? And when it comes in a way that's dangerously close to a dynasty, God takes care of it by killing the kids. Chofni Pinchas. Right? Here they didn't have to because the people reject the kids. So in a sense, the people are asking for exactly the thing that would torpedo them in this case, which is a dynasty. But what the people really want is a dynasty. They want a dynasty because a dynasty has a certain amount of security. It means when the king dies, there's somebody in place. We don't have to wait until HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides to give us another leader. But the thing about it, you know, your kids are rotten, it's kind of a convenient excuse for saying we can't continue with this system. You're right, it's a problem. So the people ask for this L'shoftenu, and I would posit that L'shoftenu, and I'll prove it to you in a minute, means we want a leader who is going to lead us in war. Right? Which already I've begun solving the problem. So take a look at what happens here. Shaul, I have to skip a bunch of stuff, but Shaul shows up and he's presented as a great guy with tremendous sense of filial responsibility. His father loses some donkeys, so he goes for days, 3 days, through Eretz Binyamin and Eretz Ephraim to look for the donkeys. Finally, he comes to Shmuel, the Navi, who's going to help him find the donkeys, and Shmuel says to him, Shmuel says, don't worry about the donkeys they've been found. And he says, what do you care anyways? You already own everything that Avim Yisrael owns. Which means, you're going to be king. Now, Shaul's no dummy. Shaul knows that everybody's asked for a king, and now the search is on for a king, and suddenly he realizes who he's pointing to. So what's his reaction? First of all, I'm Shev Binyamin. Remember, Shev Binyamin at the end of Sefer Shoftim was decimated. I'm from a tiny Shevet that is not so favored. From the smallest of the tribes. And I'm from the smallest family in Binyamin. In other words, Shmuel is saying, I am not worthy. Shaul is saying, I am not worthy of this post. Now, notice, he doesn't say, wait a second. Yaakov said, Loyasu Shev Miyuda. Of course he knows it. He doesn't say it. He doesn't say it because it's irrelevant. Why is it irrelevant? Oh, we'll see. So Shmuel then anoints Shaul. I'm not going to look at this whole section inside. You can take a peek, but I'll give you the blow-by-blow. Shaul does all sorts of things to raise Shmuel up. He invites him to sit at the head of his feast at the Korban, and he feeds him the choice piece, and he talks to him on top of the roof, and then he anoints him, and he kisses him, and he says, you are the Nagid. He doesn't say Melech. The Nagid, and then he sends him away and he gives him 3 signs by which he'll know that this is true, and they all happen, and he ends up having Nevuah, Gam Shaul Banavim, very powerful image. You notice now, in Perek Yod, when he anoints Shaul publicly, at the end of Perek Yod, here is a piece that's very telling. Vayitzak Shmuel ta'am el Hashem ami el Adonai Mitzpah, vayomer el Bnei Yisrael. God says, I saved you from all the nations. And now you've rejected me. Who saved you? So So what happens? Said, God saved you from all of these nations, and now you've rejected God and said, we'd rather have a melech. What's the equation here? So I'm going to ask you the question that's the key question of the whole shiur right now. What is the job of a melech? What is the job of a melech? To lead people into battle. In other words, he's a shofet. The difference is that a shofet belongs to a tribe, a melech belongs to the nation. A shofet is independent, a melech is part of a dynasty. And that's it. So a melech, essentially, is a glorified shofet. Okay, I'm with you on that. And that's the shoftenu. Yeah. Yeah, what does it say? Good, what does it say? Right, exactly. And by the way, in Mishpat HaMelech, in Perek Chet and Shmuel, it talks about all the things the king is going to be able to confiscate and draft and conscript for his own service. By the way, Shaul does how much of that? Shaul does how much of the other? Nada. Shlomo, story. Shaul does none of that. What does Shaul do after he's anointed? What should he do after he's anointed? Shaul is publicly anointed, and most of the people say, Yechi HaMelech, Yechi HaMelech. What should he do now? What? Organize the army. Good. What else?
Build a palace.
Then what should he do with the Aron that's sitting in Abu Ghosh? What? He has to get to all the place. Pray to God. Say to Shmuel, pray to God. Tell me where to go. Or in the meantime, go to Ramah, where the Navi lives. Or go to Gibeah. He says, what? Consolidate power. Good. Consolidate power. Organize an army. Create a capital. Create a government. Build a palace. Build a place for the Aron, or just bring the Aron and put a tent around it. Fine. How much of that does Shaul do? Not exactly. He does get an army together. But who's the army? All the guys who like him. In other words, people voluntarily follow him, and the rest of them say, eh. I'm sorry, Ma Yoshiinu Zeh, which is Hebrew for they don't father like him. They're called B'nai Belial. They're losers. Now, strange, weird behavior. Perek Yod Aleph. Shaul is Shaul HaMelech. He's the king. And suddenly there is a threat. The residents in northwest Jordan in Yavesh Gilad are being threatened by Nachash. Anybody wants to see a fascinating background to this, take a look in the Antiquities of Josephus. He gives I don't know where he got it from, a great background to this whole story. I forgot what book. You could Google it and find it very quickly. We've got to have a Hebrew word for Legagel. Okay, Gugal. Gugalti. Right. Okay, Karashmo Gilgal. And Shaul gets word while he's in Gibeah. Where is he in Gibeah in his hometown? He's sitting on his throne, judging all of the complaints of the people and trying to help them organize their army. No, what's he doing? Pasuk Pasuk what's Shaul doing? He's plowing. He's plowing in the field. And so what does he do? Ruach Hashem comes on him. He cuts the two oxen up. He sends them to the country. Anybody who doesn't come to war, this will happen to his oxen, which is kind of closing circles from Pidagash B'Givah, but that's a whole other parsha. And he takes them out to war, and they win. And then what happens? He goes back. What?
He's George Washington.
He's George Washington when? When? When is he George Washington?
Retirement.
Retirement. He's not retired. He's still the guy. There's no other guy. But he's the guy. What does he do? He goes back and he plows. And of course, if there's another war, he'll come to war. Now, they have another public coronation. And Shmuel again reads the riot act to the people. And how does he describe it? Take a look on your own. He says, look at this. God saved you. And he lists all the nations that afflicted you. And God saved you from them. And now you've rejected God and you've demanded a melech. Which means, from Shmuel's perspective, what is the job of this particular melech? to act in the place of God as the savior from oppression that they've been experiencing. And take a look carefully. Pasuk Yod Bet, Vatiru ki nachash melech bnei amon ba'alechem. Every other time that an enemy came and hurt you, God saved you. And now you saw Nachash coming and you said, Vatomru li, lo. What does lo mean? No to God. Ki meaning rather, melech imloch aleinu. Va'adonai lechem alkechem. What's that vav? That's called vav ha-nigud. Conversive vav. But it's not like you think God is your king. Not some guy. But nonetheless, God acceded to it. And indeed, if you remain loyal to God, etc., etc. So, effectively, the role that Shaul is playing, and the role that Shmuel seems to be describing, is a role of melech warlord. Now, he does not have a scepter. He is not a lawgiver. He does not play that role. Which means, if you think about it, the entire question of how can somebody from Shevet Binyamin be a melech isn't a question, because he's not a melech. He's a shofet, a nagid, a melech for the purposes of war, but not for anything else. But not the melech Yaakov described with a scepter and a lawgiver. He doesn't play that role. Now, parenthetically, I've got to say something which may sound controversial and may belong to a panel. Well, I'll say it anyways. What would happen if Shaul had succeeded, as evidently the potential was there for, and had become a full melech and had built a dynasty, which was true until he brought the korban too early and Shmuel said to him, you blew it, you were going to have a dynasty, now you're not going to have it. What would we then do with the pasuk in Bereshit? Exactly. Exactly. Lo yasur shev miyudah. I'll explain. Lo yasur shev miyudah. I have to say something very important about nevuah and about murky verses. All prophecies are murky. And the longer the range, the murkier they are. So prophecies about the end of days, prophecies about that are fairly close, like Yeshayahu talking to Chizkiyahu about what's going to happen with Melech Ashur, they're somewhat murky. Why are they murky? Because nobody knows how they're going to exactly play out. And we only know how they play out after they play out and say, if we have a Navi, he could point to it. If we don't have a Navi, he could say, maybe, probably, hopefully, that's what it meant. Can I tell you with absolute certitude that the 20th century return to Zion and establishment of the State of Israel is the prophecy of Shivat Zion? I can't. I'm not a Navi. I hope it is. And then I can point to all the Nevuot and say, aha, that's how that happened and that's what that means. Maybe. But nevuot are murky. So when Yaakov says, lo yasur shev miyudah, it could mean a lot of different things. It may mean that the king is going to be whoever the king is, and he's going to have a guy who's the lawgiver who will be from Shevet Yehudah. It could mean like the Ramban reads, lo yasur shev miyudah means, once it comes to Yehudah, it should never leave him. But it can be with somebody else beforehand. It can mean a lot of things. We have the convenience of hindsight to say it means that Yehudah will be the kings because a young man from Yehudah earned that spot named David, and then God promised him explicitly without any equivocation that you and your children will be the kings forever. Except when you're not, which is when your son messes up, and as a result of that, Ephraim gets a king that's going to last for a few generations until that finally gets wiped out. But essentially, there will always be a king of Judea that will come from David. But before that happens, I can interpret it any way I want. But in the meantime, I don't need to, because Shaul never made it. Now, just one interesting thought with which to leave you. I'm not a big fan of numbers. That's not true. I'm a big fan of numbers, especially if they're on a check. But I'm not a big fan of numerology, except when we're talking about typological numbers. Typological numbers is a vehicle that the text uses all the time. Sevens and threes and in all sorts of ways. It uses number structure to communicate certain things. I don't mean all those codes and all that other nonsense. And nonsense is the nicest thing I could say about it. But see, the text very definitely recognizes that seven symbolizes certain things, three symbolizes certain things, etc. There was an ancient pagan symbol we're all familiar with. throughout the pagan world that was known, that was a star of 6 points. Sort of two triangles overlaid. So it had 6 points. There's a pagan symbol, had certainly no Jewish connection whatsoever. Suddenly, in medieval times, Jews adopted this sign and started calling it a Magen David. Where'd that come from? I'll show you where I think it came from. Six. I'll show you. You'll see why. You'll see why. Vayomer Shmuel al Shaul. Sorry. Take a look at the fourth source from the bottom of page 2. I apologize that it's so crowded in. Vekach Shaul shloshet alafim ish. When Shaul goes to war, he takes 3,000 men. In another place, he takes 300 men. By the way, that is a typological number. It's a typological number that is used without cessation throughout Sefer Shoftim. Who is the most famous Shofet, although assuredly the most failed Shofet? Shimshon, right. Shimshon went to get married. How many guys joined him in the entourage? 30. He made a bet, and on the third day, they started pestering his wife to get the answer to the riddle. Famous riddle about the honey. As a result of him losing the bet, he had to go and kill 30 men in Ashkelon and bring 30 suits back, and then he walks away. He comes back and wants to take vengeance on the Plishtim, so what does he do? He takes 300 foxes and ties the tails together and puts torches in there, and Pita comes out in protest, burns down the Plishtim thing. A little while later, he is hiding out, and the Plishtim come after him, and so Yehuda sends 3,000 men to collect him. That's when he kills all the police team with the jawbone of the ass, right? Thus reminding us of many political leaders. In any case, not the power, but the jawbone. He then is finally brought down by Delilah and the sex games that they're playing. And he comes to, well, I don't know what you think it is. That's the way to read the text, I think. And he's brought down to Dagon's temple. And he's brought out. And if you remember, he really, really made headlines because he brought the house down. And when he brought the house down, how many people were on the upper story who died? 3,000. There is no question that the number 30 and 303,000 are typological numbers of Shoftim. Now, an interesting thing. You look through Shaul's career and you continue to find the same numbers. Matter of fact, something really bizarre happens. When we're given the biography of Shaul, we're told that Shaul has 3 sons. Thus, reminding us of Fred McMurray. Anybody old enough to remember that? Okay, good. He has 3 sons, Yonatan, Malkishua, Yishvi, and Malkishua. But wait a second, he has a 4th son, Eshbaal. Well, he's called Ishbosheth here. That's a censored version. His name is Eshbaal, right? But he has another son. Why isn't he listed here? Because the text wants to use him in threes. You know why? Because the first time we meet David, you know what we're told? The first time we meet David's family, you know what we're told? He has 6 sons. And when David goes out to war with his posse, how many men does he have? 600. What's the text trying to say? That there are 2 components to a king. Shaul has only 1. A king is the leader of the army, he's the commander-in-chief. A king is also the political and religious leader that unites the people. Shaul has only 1 of those components. And therefore, everything with him is the Shofet model. David has both components, and that's why he has the 6, and that's why David, and that's why medieval Jews took a look at that 6-pointed star and called it Magen David. They never called it Magen Shaul. So Magen David. Hold on one second. An allusion to this. What is the foreshadowing book of David? The book in Tanakh, which foreshadows David because it's the ancestry of David. Gilat Rut. In the book of Rut, a very bizarre thing happens in the middle of the night. Boaz and Rut have had their fateful meeting at which nothing happened, although much happened, but nothing happened, you know, for National Enquirer. Nothing happened. And Boaz then hands Rut some barley, and he gives her 6 pieces of barley, and he says to her, these 6 pieces of barley I'm giving you so you should not come home empty-handed to Naomi. And the Midrash picks up on that. It says, these 6 pieces of barley represent the 6 tzaddikim that will come out of Ruth, which are David and Shlomo, etc., etc. In other words, the text makes a big deal about the number 6. Everybody's interested. I developed the theme a lot more in some online shiurim I wrote about Megillat Ruth. You could send an email. I'll be happy to send them to you. Just an email address at the bottom. In any case, what we did over the course of the last 45 minutes or 47 minutes was to look at some of the issues in Bereishit and look at some of the role of Yaakov on his deathbed and what he was apportioning out. We looked specifically at the role of Yehuda as the leader. We noted that we could interpret that text differently if we needed to, but we don't need to because Shaul really never rises to the position that Yaakov imagined for Yehuda. Shaul was simply a shofet with the potential of dynasty. It was only when David came along that the full Malchut came together, that unified the people, that allowed a palace, allowed a mikdash, allowed a central government, and indeed, David Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayam. Thank you. I've had a wonderful time being here. I only wish I were awake for it. And we'll see you next time.